Greetings all. We begin the 18th chapter, The Divine Worker, which saw its publication on the 15th of January in 1918 in the Aria. The issue opened with The Life Divine. The title chapter was The Fundamental Character of the Ignorance. Then came Synthesis of Yoga, and the chapter was titled Samadhi. And then, of course, Essays on the Gita, The Divine Worker. For several chapters, he's been discussing the idea of the incarnation of the divine as a descent from a supreme consciousness to occupy a significant place in the world order, such as to advance it from one status of being to another status of being, to add to greaten, to amplify, and also to protect. Of course, the verse in the Gita in the fourth chapter draws attention to upholding the Dharma. And the Dharma is the law of the universe derived from the great consciousness of the Supreme, from the right world order. It effectuates all things here. And the human version of Dharma should be in consonance with that universal order, which is progressive, harmonic. So when things fall out of harmony, as we have a want to make happen, then the divine sometimes must personally come and descend. Now, this is a furtherance of a Vedantic idea that all is one, that there is a supreme reality transcendent to all configurations, but also that same reality puts something of itself, invests something of its real self and consciousness and sense of values into the cosmic manifestation. And as we are part of the cosmic manifestation, that individuality with a capital I is in the heart of all of our individualities as well. But we don't know that. We live on the front of ourselves in the appearances of what we might be and identify with a very transient ego and a very fallible body, and forget our immortal source inside. So during this conversation that Krishna is having with Arjuna, he's pressing upon him the need to rise to a new consciousness which is in alignment with the truth, and to recognize his identity with the Supreme Being so that he can work in this world effectively, spiritually, still with a sense of satisfaction and delight. So, who is this divine worker? Sri Aurobindo now, in this chapter, begins to express that a little more clearly to us. So, to attain to the divine birth, a divinizing new birth of the soul into a higher consciousness, and to do divine works, both as a means towards that before it is attained, and as an expression of it after it is attained, is then all the karma yoga of the Gita. So this path through works is an ascent and a descent. It is a path up and a path back. On the path up, you learn how to yoke yourself, to become yukta with the divine. But that doesn't end the matter. Now you have to come back and demonstrate that divinity in all of life's innings. The Gita does not try to define works. by any outward signs through which it can be recognizable to an external gaze, measurable by the criticism of the world. It deliberately renounces even the ordinary ethical distinctions by which men seek to guide themselves in the light of the human reason. The signs by which it distinguishes divine works are all profoundly intimate and subjective. The stamp by which they are known is invisible, spiritual, supra-ethical. You'll remember Arjuna asks, well, how does such a sage stand? How does he sit? How does he speak? And Krishna's answers are all to the inner side of things. You can't know the interiority of another being unless you grow your consciousness inwardly, outwardly, so that you become one with what you truly are and one with what all is. That's how you know. So what are these signs? Remember, we're going to, essentially in the first half of this chapter, see that there are four things that demarcate what this divine worker looks like. First, he will be seated in the truth, and so his work will be true. He'll know, capital K. The work will be desireless, has no object for one's own being. So in addition to true work and desireless work, then the work is egoless. Finally, it is work done from equality, equal to all situations, all seasons, but done with an equal eye to all beings and all forces and all realities. So let's start again, the second paragraph. These signs are recognizable only by the light of the soul from which they come. For it says, what is action and what is inaction? As to this, even the sages are perplexed and deluded. Because, judging by practical, social, ethical, intellectual standards, they discriminate by accidentals and do not get to the root of the matter. I will declare to thee that action, by the knowledge of which thou shalt be released from all ills. One has to understand about action as well as to understand about wrong action and about inaction, one has to understand. Thick and tangled is the way of works. So these are shlokas 16 and 17 in chapter 4. Gahana karmano gatihi. Action in the world is like a deep forest, gahana, through which man goes stumbling as best he can by the light of the ideas of his time, the standards of his personality, his environment, or rather of many times, many personalities, layers of thought and ethics from many social stages, all inextricably confused together, temporal and conventional amidst all their claim to absoluteness and immutable truth, empirical and irrational in spite of their aping of right reason. And each one of these ethical systems will claim to be based upon dharma, which is itself the manifestation of vritta, the right order of truth of being in action. No. And finally, the sage seeking in the midst of it all a highest foundation of fixed law and an original truth finds himself obliged to raise the last supreme question, whether All action and life itself are not a delusion and a snare, and whether cessation from action, a karma, is not the last resort of the tired and disillusioned human soul. But, says Krishna, in this matter, even the sages are perplexed and deluded. The sages, kavayaha, deluded, mohita. For by action, by works, not by inaction, comes the knowledge and the release. This is a point Sri Aurobindo has made in his letters and in his philosophic writings as well, that you can withdraw from the world. You can, like the sannyasi, like the Buddhist monk, pull away and out of the world. And by isolating yourself from contact with this very confusing and challenging universe, arrive at some sort of equanimity. Merge yourself, perhaps, into that which stands behind the universe, whatever that might be, whatever you want to call it. But is that seat a seat really of freedom? You don't know until you come back and try to work in that new consciousness in the world. Because if it is truly free, then your return to the world, even though the world is dark, like a forest, gahana karmano gatihi, thick and tangled, you won't know that your release is real, is true, is valid. You're protected. You're in a sheath covered from the materiality, the vitality, the mentality of the world. So, if you want to be free, dynamically as well as in a serene place inside yourself, you have to be able to take that serenity and act upon it in the world. So that's what we see, I think, most profoundly in the image of Nataraj, creating, sustaining, manifesting the universe in all its beauty and its violence. But always the eyes are closed because it signifies that he's inside, has never lost his sense of infinity and unwalled conscious being. As opposed to the sage, whichever statue you point at, and they're sitting there silently, well, good for you. And it is good. It is good to be released, but come back, test it. Come out of those caves, as Sri Aurobindo says in the Synthesis of Yoga, and rejoin life. It's time for all the sages to come flooding out of the caves and enter into life here in the world. Bring that spiritual luster and bring that power that you have gained inside and help us save and divinize this world, here and now. Ihaiva. I'll stop. Back to Sri Aurobindo. It says it much more beautifully. What then is the solution? What is that type of works by which we shall be released from the ills of life, from this doubt, this error, this grief, from this mixed, impure, and baffling result, even of our purest and best intentioned acts, from these million forms of evil and suffering? No outward distinctions need be made, is the reply. No work the world needs be shunned. No limit or hedge set round our human activities. On the contrary, all actions should be done, but from a soul in yoga with the divine. Yuktaha Kritsna Karma Krit 4:18. A karma, cessation from action, is not the way. The man who has attained to the insight of the highest reason perceives that such inaction is itself a constant action, a state subject to the workings of nature and her qualities. The mind that takes refuge in physical inactivity is still under the delusion that it and not nature is the doer of works. It has mistaken inertia for liberation. It does not see that even in what seems absolute inertia greater than that of the stone or clod, nature is at work, keeps unimpaired her hold. On the contrary, in the full flood of action, the soul is free from its works, is not the doer, not bound by what is done. And he who lives in the freedom of the soul and not in the bondage of the modes of nature alone has release from works. This is what the Gita clearly means when it says that he who in action can see inaction and can see action still continuing in cessation from works is the man of true reason and discernment among men. Action, karma. Inaction, akarma. This is again 418. Man of true reason and discernment. Again, Sri Aurobindo's translation of buddhi, buddhiman. This saying hinges upon the Sankhya distinction between purusha and prakriti, between the free, inactive soul, eternally calm, pure, and unmoved in the midst of works, and ever active nature, operative as much in inertia and cessation as in the overt turmoil of her visible hurry of labor. This is the knowledge which the highest effort of the discriminating reason, the buddhi, gives to us, and therefore, whoever possesses it is the truly rational and discerning man. Sa buddhiman munushyesu. Ah. Not the perplexed thinker who judges life and works by the external, uncertain, and impermanent distinctions of the lower reason. That's 418. Let's read the English translation that Sri Aurobindo provides. He who sees inaction in action and action in inaction, he is wise among men. He is in yoga and a universal worker. Therefore, the liberated man is not afraid of action. He is a large and universal doer of all works, kritsna karma krit, not as others do them in subjection to nature, but poised in the silent calm of the soul, tranquilly in yoga with the divine. The divine is the lord of his works. He is only their channel through the instrumentality of his nature, conscious of and subject to her lord. By the flaming intensity and purity of this knowledge, all his works are burned up as in a fire, and his mind remains without any stain or disfiguring mark from them, calm, silent, unperturbed, white and clean and pure. To do all in this liberating knowledge without the personal egoism of the doer is the first sign of the divine worker. So you can see we're moving shloka by shloka through the chapter. Now we're up to about 419. In the fourth chapter of the Gita, I mean. So that's the first. The second sign is freedom from desire. For where there is not the personal egoism of the doer, desire becomes impossible. It is starved out, sinks for want of a support, dies of inanition. Outwardly, the liberated man seems to undertake works of all kinds, like other men, on a larger scale, perhaps, with a more powerful will and driving force, for the might of the divine will works in his active nature. But from all his inceptions and undertakings, the inferior concept and nether will of desire is entirely banished. Sarve samarambha kama sankalpa vajita. Sorry. 419. He has abandoned all attachment to the fruits of his works. And where one does not work for the fruit, but solely as an impersonal instrument of the master of works, desire can find no place, not even the desire to serve successfully. For the fruit is the Lord's and determined by him, and not by the personal will and effort, or to serve with credit and to the master's satisfaction. For the real doer is the Lord himself, and all glory belongs to a form of his Shakti, missioned in the nature, and not to the limited human personality. The human mind and soul of the liberated man does nothing. Na kinchit karoti. That's 420. Even though, through his nature, he engages in action, it is the nature, the executive Shakti, it is the conscious goddess governed by the divine inhabitant who does the work. Sri Aurobindo has, of course, added this because he is a worshiper of the Divine Mother. He is at one with the Mahashakti. This is not something that appears in the Gita itself. So this is clearly Sri Aurobindo's insertion into the text here. It does not follow that the work is not to be done perfectly, with success, with a right adaptation of means to ends. On the contrary, a perfect working is easier to action done tranquilly in yoga than to action done in the blindness of hopes and fears, lamed by the judgments of the stumbling reason, running about amidst the eager trepidations of the hasty human will. Yoga, says the Gita elsewhere, is the true skill in works. Yoga karmasu kaushalam. That's back in chapter 2, shloka 50. But all this is done impersonally by the action of a great universal light and power operating through the individual nature. In other words, if you let the divine work through you without interfering, the work is done more smoothly. Nothing in your nature is upset or ruffled by it. Action becomes truly efficient. You become a better worker when you are not the author of everything. The Karma Yogin knows that the power given to him will be adapted to the fruit decreed, the divine thought behind the work equated with the work he has to do, the will in him, which will not be wish or desire, but an impersonal drive of conscious power directed towards an aim not his own, subtly regulated in its energy and direction by the divine wisdom. The result may be success, as the ordinary mind understands it, or it may seem to that mind to be defeat and failure. But to him, it is always the success intended, not by him, but by the all-wise manipulator of action and result, because he does not seek for victory, but only for the fulfillment of the divine will and wisdom, which works out its ends through apparent failure, as well as, and often with greater force than through apparent triumph. Arjuna, bidden to fight, is assured of victory. But even if certain defeat were before him, he must still fight, because that is the present work assigned to him as his immediate share in the great sum of energies by which the divine will is surely accomplished. So really, we cannot judge from outside. and the work may or may not be successful as humanity will gauge it. But if it is not immediately successful, it is preparing a greater success. It may seem to have turned left or to have turned right and forbidden further progress on the course. No, there's another course being prepared. Other steps will lead us there, and eventually the destination is secured. The divine destination, again, not how humanity maps it out. We do have this tendency to unroll a map of time unconsciously, you know, that the future looks like the present and the past, and we just roll it out there and think we just walk along it. That is a very ignorant view of time and cosmos, I might say. So, be ready for the divine's moment. The hour of God comes. Brahma Muhurta comes. And it always divinely reveals what was not seen before. The ratiocination of the human mind can't measure. The liberated man has no personal hopes. He does not seize on things as his personal possessions. He receives what the divine will brings him, covets nothing, is jealous of none. What comes to him, he takes without repulsion and without attachment. What goes from him, he allows to depart into the whirl of things without repining or grief or sense of loss. His heart and self are under perfect control. They are free from reaction and passion. They make no turbulent response to the touches of outward things. His action is indeed a purely physical action. Shariram kevalam karma. For all else comes from above. That's 421. Is not generated on the human plane. Is only a reflection of the will, knowledge, joy, of the divine Purushottama. Again, we could note that this is Sri Aurobindo's personal experience from Alipur on. So for 40 years, this is a statement true of Sri Aurobindo and the nature of the action that he took in the world. Therefore, he does not, by a stress on doing and its objects, bring about in his mind and heart any of those reactions which we call passion and sin. For sin consists not at all in the outward deed, but in an impure reaction of the personal will, mind, and heart, which accompanies it or causes it. The impersonal, the spiritual, is always pure, apapa vidham, and gives to all that it does its own inalienable purity. This spiritual impersonality is a third sign of the divine worker. All human souls, indeed, who have attained to a certain greatness and largeness are conscious of an impersonal force or love or will and knowledge working through them. But they are not free from egoistic reactions, sometimes violent enough, of their human personality. But this freedom the liberated soul has attained, for he has cast his personality into the impersonal, where it is no longer his, but is taken up by the divine person, the Purushottama, who uses all finite qualities infinitely and freely and is bound by none. He has become a soul and ceased to be a sum of natural qualities. And such appearance of personality as remains for the operations of nature is something unbound, large, flexible, universal. It is a free mold for the infinite. It is a living mask of the Purushottama. So, not simply a personality stuck in the mold of Prakriti as given by nature upon birth, but now outgrowing that. So, with mother, whenever you saw mother, you saw a different face of the mother. She was never the same, no moment, and no photograph of her looks like another photograph. She's absolutely in a state of constant change, transformation. One power of the great goddess manifesting in her, displaced by another a moment later. All of it articulating something meaningful in the earth atmosphere, something to push it, direct it, guide it, lead it, but eventually pick it up and carry it if necessary. Sri Aurobindo, too, we think of him as being impersonal, seated like the Himalayas in his rooms in the ashram above and beyond the life of the ashram below him. But read his poetry. He was a thousand personalities. Everything was possible in his plenitude of being. So the dexterity with which the divine worker picks up this instrument or this style or that style, always different, yet always the same inside. Always one, never discordant. Sometimes Krishna might be naughty. Sometimes he might be virtuous. But he was always divine. The result of this knowledge, this desirelessness, and this impersonality is a perfect equality in the soul and the nature. Equality is the fourth sign of the divine worker, samatha. He has, says the Gita, passed beyond the dualities. He is dvandvatita, 422. We have seen that he regards with equal eyes, without any disturbance of feeling, failure and success, victory and defeat. But not only these, all dualities are in him surpassed and reconciled. The outward distinctions by which men determine their psychological attitude towards the happenings of the world have for him only a subordinate and instrumental meaning. He does not ignore them, but he is above them. Good happening and evil happening, so all important to the human soul subject to desire, are to the desireless divine soul equally welcome, since by their mingled strand are worked out the developing forms of the eternal good. He cannot be defeated, since all for him is moving towards the divine victory in the Kurukshetra of nature. Dharmakshetra, Kurukshetra. The field of doings, which is the field of the evolving Dharma. And every turn of the conflict has been designed and mapped by the foreseeing eye of the master of the battle, the lord of works and guide of the Dharma. Yes, now this is the opening shloka in the Gita. Bhagavad Gita, chapter 1, first shloka. Dharma Kshetra Kurukshetra. Honor and dishonor from men cannot move him, nor their praise, nor their blame. For he has a greater clear-seeing judge and another standard for his action, and his motive admits no dependence upon worldly rewards. Arjuna the Kshatriya prizes naturally honor and reputation, and is right in shunning disgrace and the name of coward as worse than death. For to maintain the point of honor and the standard of courage in the world is part of his dharma. But Arjuna, the liberated soul, need care for none of these things. He has only to know the kartavyam karma, the work which the Supreme Self demands from him, and to do that and leave the result to the Lord of his actions. Well, this goes back to chapter 3, shloka 22, and it's not exactly expressed there like that, kartavyam karma, but that's the way we speak about it in shorthand. The work that must be done. He has passed even beyond that distinction of sin and virtue, which is so all important to the human soul while it is struggling to minimize the hold of its egoism and lighten the heavy and violent yoke of its passions. The liberated has risen above these struggles and is seated firmly in the purity of the witnessing and enlightened soul. Sin has fallen away from him, and not a virtue acquired and increased by good action and impaired or lost by evil action, but the inalienable and unalterable purity of a divine and selfless nature is the peak to which he has climbed and the seat upon which he is founded. There, the sense of sin and the sense of virtue have no starting point or applicability. So we're about halfway through the chapter, and that's where we put our bookmark this time. And I'll read to you a section from Savitri, but before doing that, I'll just say again that we'll finish these first 24 essays in Essays on the Gita, this first series, and then we'll pause. I think if we go at our current rate, probably in the middle or latter part of January, we'll finish this first series. And then, as we typically do in the month of February, maybe a little before it, we'll spend some time with the book, The Mother. It's a short book, but we're going to spend probably something like a month with it, as we did a few years ago. And then when we come back, after finishing that in February, we'll do something new together. Perhaps there'll be a series of themes that connect in a meaningful way for you, something that is significant. And perhaps we can do something which would invite questions and answers after I give a preliminary talk, speak for 20, 30 minutes, and then open the floor to questions, because it seems that most of us are on Zoom. We do have sometimes a few people sitting in the room here in the center with us, but many people, even in Pensacola now, attend by Zoom. Everybody is welcome to come, and you are all welcome to come to Pensacola and crowd this room. We'll take good care of you, or die trying. But anyway, that's what we intend for later. And hopefully it will be meaningful and useful to you in the practice of yoga, the integral yoga of Sri Aurobindo. So if you'll permit me, I'll read a section from Savitri. This is in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings. This is in Canto 4, The Secret Knowledge. And we'll start on page 55. A consciousness that knows not its own truth, a vagrant hunter of misleading dawns, Between the being's dark and luminous ends moves here in a half-light that seems the whole. An interregnum in reality cuts off the integral thought, the total power. It circles or stands in a vague interspace, doubtful of its beginning and its close, or runs upon a road that has no end. Far from the original dusk, the final flame in some huge void in conscience, it lives like a thought persisting in a wide emptiness. As if an unintelligible phrase suggested a million renderings to the mind, it lends a purport to a random world, a conjecture leaning upon doubtful proofs, a message misunderstood, a thought confused, missing its aim is all that it can speak, or a fragment of the universal word. It leaves two giant letters void of sense, while without sanction turns the middle sign, carrying an enigmatic universe, as if a present without future or past, repeating the same revolution's whirl, turned on its axis in its own inane. Thus is the meaning of creation veiled, for without context reads the cosmic page. Its signs stare at us like an unknown script, as if appeared screened by a foreign tongue or code of splendor, signs without a key, a portion of a parable sublime. It wears to the perishable creature's eyes the grandeur of a useless miracle, wasting itself that it may last a while, a river that can never find its sea. It runs through life and death on an edge of time. A fire in the night is its mighty action's blaze. This is our deepest need, to join once more what now is parted, opposite and twain, remote in sovereign spheres that never meet, or fronting like far poles of night and day. We must fill the immense lacuna we have made, re-wed the closed finite's lonely consonant with the open vowels of infinity. A hyphen must connect matter and mind, the narrow isthmus of the ascending soul. We must renew the secret bond in things, our hearts recall the lost divine idea, reconstitute the perfect word, unite the Alpha and the Omega in one sound. Then shall the spirit and nature be at one. So, do I see Vasanti Rao on the screen? Somebody capture that image. The goddess has come. We have invoked the goddess. I don't know how we did it, but somebody do it again. Listen, it's a pleasure to see you all. Thank you for joining tonight. See you again soon, I hope. It will be a blessing to me. Much love to you all. Namaste. Jai Ma.